From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, problems in the military's mental health system. We talk with reporters Lisa Chetico and Matthew Kaufman of the Hartford Courant about their series Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight. It won a George Polk Award. They found that soldiers are being medicated with antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs and sent back into battle, and that service members with post-traumatic stress disorder are being redeployed. Also, we talk with Jonathan Lethem about his new comic novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Riches, the new FX cable drama series starring Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The American military is increasingly relying on psychotropic medications like anti-anxiety pills and antidepressants to keep service members in combat, according to a series published in the Hartford Courant. The series, called Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight, investigated problems in the military's mental health system. It also reported that the military has deployed, retained, and redeployed troops with psychological problems in violation of its own regulations. A growing number of troops with post-traumatic stress disorder have been sent back to Iraq for second, third, and fourth tours of duty. These articles were published last May. Last month, the reporters Matthew Kaufman and Lisa Chetical won a George Polk Award, which will be presented at a ceremony April 12th. We invited them to tell us what they learned. They had set out to investigate what happens when a soldier has a pronounced mental health problem. I asked them how mental health problems are treated in combat.
Typically, and then there are kind of different kinds of psychiatric disorders that might come up in the theater if it's pre-existing or if it's in theater, but the sort of classic combat stress that a soldier suffers some sort of stress on the battlefield, typically what the military does, if anything, is kind of remove them sort of half a step back from the front and what they call three hots in a cot, kind of give them, you know, a decent bed to sleep in and a shower they can get and maybe some better food, and then often puts them on antidepressant medication or sleep medication. And then 72 hours later, even though that's less time than the medication takes to work, if it's going to work at all, they go right back to the front. And we had found a lot of folks in the military that thought that that was therapeutically a good idea, but an awful lot of people outside the military in the psychiatric community that thought it was a mistake.
And the other issue we found, Terry, in terms of treatment in combat was a heavy reliance on psychotropic drugs, which was news to some people. I mean, it's the first war that's been fought since the SSRIs, which are the big class of psychotropic drugs, have been developed. And we found that increasingly as the war progressed, the military was relying on Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Celexa, Wellbutrin. That was a concern for mental health professionals because the FDA has cautioned and experts agree that you have to really carefully monitor somebody who's placed on those medications, especially early on. There can be an increase in suicidal impulses or homicidal impulses, and you have to provide counseling and monitoring. Well, that's very hard to do in a war zone, closely monitor somebody, and it's also difficult to stay in touch with that soldier when you've sent him back to his unit and that kind of thing. So we looked pretty closely at the use of those drugs, found a number of instances anecdotally from soldiers, both alive and those who had killed themselves in combat, where they had been placed on these drugs, in some cases shortly before committing suicide, had been put on these drugs without counseling, without close monitoring, ended up going into a porta potty, pulling the trigger, killing themselves, and the family learned after the fact that there had been medication dispensed to the soldiers soon before this happened.
Are antidepressants considered to be effective in dealing with the type of depression or combat stress that soldiers face in war zones?
There is some early clinical work on medication and PTSD. I mean, they haven't sort of specifically tested antidepressants on a combat stress population. There is, at least anecdotally, some suggestion that it may sort of be a helpful thing, but it's more an issue. I mean, folks we talked to did not say, and we certainly didn't report in the story, that antidepressants, among a military population is a bad idea and that, you know, should never be given. But there are some sort of requirements that the FDA has, that the psychiatric community has, for the use of them, and that's sort of where we found that things fell apart. Where there is decent evidence that they do not work is in the short term, and that they take somewhere from 2 weeks to up to 6 weeks before they sort of have a therapeutic and a valuable effect. And that's where there was a real disconnect between how they were being used in the military and how the research community says they ought to be used.
Now, you found that there were several instances where soldiers were clearly behaving suicidally and had threatened suicide, and that behavior was ignored or overlooked, and they ended up killing themselves. Would you tell us one of those stories?
We had identified, the military does not identify suicides. It includes suicide deaths in a much larger pool of non-hostile deaths. But we had gone through that pool and kind of through a partly process of elimination and making lots of calls to family, had identified, we think, every suicide in 2005, and spoke with a number of families, some of them for the very first time they had ever spoken outside, sort of a very close circle of family, about what had happened to their loved ones. I spoke to the parents of PFC Jason Shoreman of Virginia, who had actually written a suicide note to his mother and emailed it to her sort of overnight. And she woke up to this email saying, you know, I can't take it anymore, Mom. You know, I'm sorry. I love you, but goodbye. And she was ex-military herself and sort of understood the military and was able to call through the chain of command and get to someone in Iraq and get a commander and a chaplain over to her son in time. And then got an email from him later saying, Mom, they think I'm faking. They think I'm just making all this up to get out of work. And they ultimately cut off his contact with his parents, and they sort of gave him menial jobs and punished him and humiliated him. And within a number of days following that, he had slipped away and shot himself. We found a number of very tragic cases like that. Lisa, why don't you talk about Jeff Henthorne?
Jeff Henthorne was a 25-year-old soldier from small town Choctaw, Oklahoma, who was deployed to Iraq for the first time early in the war. He came home, and the family immediately noticed signs of what they thought was combat stress. He was different. He was having nightmares. He was talking about an incident where his tank he was in rolled over a young Iraqi boy who was about the same age as his young son. So he came home very different, and the family was concerned about it, but did get orders to redeploy for a second tour. Shortly before he redeployed, there was an incident at Fort Riley where he smashed up his car and took a knife and slashed his arm. The family did not know about it at the time, but Jeffrey's friends did, and his superiors in his unit were made aware of it. But he was sent back over to Iraq anyway, and had an incident shortly after he got there where another sort of suicide threat, where he locked himself in a portable toilet with his gun. His superiors thought he might be trying to harm himself, burst in, talked to him for a half an hour, and handed him back his gun. And he did end up killing himself about 6 weeks later. So it's a situation where there were clear signs that he was in distress. I mean, enough that he made at least two suicide gestures. And his family is, you know, still 2 years later, he killed himself in February 2005, searching for answers about how this was allowed to happen.
My guests are Matthew Kaufman and Lisa Chedical. They won a George Polk Award for their series in the Hartford Current called Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Matthew Kaufman and Lisa Chedical of the Hartford Current about their series Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight, investigating problems in the military's mental health system. It won a George Polk Award. So in your investigative series in the Hartford Current, you've reported that the military doesn't seem to have taken mental health problems as seriously as it should have. Some soldiers who exhibited suicidal tendencies were kept in the war zone. Some of them were redeployed in spite of signs of post-traumatic stress syndrome. An increasing number of soldiers are being given psychotropic drugs like antidepressants without psychiatric follow-up. Is there any evidence that this is connected to the fact that the military troops are kind of stretched thin and there's pressure to maintain troops at certain levels.
There's no question that the fighting force is stretched thin and that the military has had some recruiting problems and has lowered recruiting standards in order to keep the numbers up. There is some evidence that we got. Certainly there's sort of a widespread belief that troop shortfalls are an element of this, of why mentally unfit troops may have been sent in the first place and why troops who developed problems in theater were kept there nonetheless. And we did speak to at least one military official who acknowledged that that troop strength was an element of this. But it may not be the only reason that mental health sort of doesn't get the attention that it deserves in the military, that as a nation we've kind of been slow to treat mental health the way it should be, and that the military that has kind of a macho, suck it up, you know, tough guy element to it is maybe a little slower than even the nation as a whole in sort of recognizing and appreciating mental health issues.
Now, there is legislation that resulted from your articles, you know, in reaction to your articles. Well, why don't you describe it for us?
We actually got, to our surprise, fairly quick congressional reaction from Joe Lieberman and Barbara Boxer, proposing legislation that would improve pre-deployment screening and call for more closely monitoring soldiers who develop psychiatric problems in theater. That legislation got changed. I.e. a little bit watered down, but was in fact adopted by Congress, basically leaving it to the military to make improvements to mental health screening and treatment. And in November, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health, William Winkenwerder, issued a brand new set of guidelines for treating soldiers with psychiatric problems in combat, which does make some significant changes. It requires that if a soldier is demonstrating some kind of a mental problem before deployment, that soldier should not be deployed unless he's been stable for at least 3 months prior to deployment. It talks about if a soldier has been placed on psychotropic drugs or is taking psychotropic drugs prior to deployment, there has to be stability and no significant side effects before that soldier can be deployed. And if there are problems that develop, mental health issues that develop with a service member in the war zone that are not resolved within 2 weeks, that service member should be evacuated home or to a hospital for treatment. That's all new stuff. I mean, right now it's, you know, before this policy went into effect, it was very much broad guidelines on how you screen and treat soldiers. So this is at least a first step toward strengthening the screening and treatment of troops in the war zone.
And especially significant because for years, the military had been telling Congress, and then during our reporting, had been telling us that really there was no problem here, that the system in place was adequate and was working. And so this was sort of the first acknowledgement, frankly, we got from the military that, you know, maybe some changes were needed. Was a fairly sweeping revamp of their policies.
How did you first start writing this story? What got you started on it?
It was really sort of a hunch and kind of poking around this general area. We did know, both Lisa and I were actually kind of looking at slightly different areas but related to the Iraq War and the military. And both sort of started wondering that with issues we knew with the troop shortfalls and that the lowering of standards and what appeared to be just a gap between what the military needed and what the military was able to get in terms of manpower. You just wonder if the troops' mental fitness is sort of getting the attention it deserves, both before they go over and when they're there and after they come back from one tour and are headed to another. So it wasn't really a specific incident or government report or anything like that. It was just kind of we asked a question and then set out to answer it.
Where did you start looking?
Yeah, basically, we sort of start by, you know, reading everything we can, congressional testimony and military reports and standards and the like. And then after a while, from reading stuff, you can kind of identify who some of the main players are and who might, you know, be knowledgeable on this, either soldier advocates or people within the government, either in the military or on the legislative side, and sort of start talking to people and then start honing in on people who will be in the story. And so from that, you know, once we had identified some likely families, started, you know, frankly, just sort of cold calling. And that was a very difficult part of this, calling people kind of out of the blue, suspecting strongly, but frankly not knowing that their loved one had had committed suicide. And week after week, we had some bunch of difficult calls to make, just calling families and saying, you know, we're working on the story about some non-hostile deaths, and, you know, we'd like to talk to you about Bobby or about David or about Tina or, you know, any of a number. And we're generally surprised by the response that, that found a lot of people almost welcomed the call. I mean, had sort of held this inside them, had never spoken about it, and did have questions and did have concerns. And so that then became a significant part of it. So sort of built the story on kind of the, you know, official side, the paper-driven side, and the statistical side, and then also on the anecdotal side by talking with families.
When you were making these cold calls to families who had loved ones that you suspected died of suicide, did you end up telling the family members things that they didn't know? Did you have information they didn't have?
In some cases, yes, we did. In some cases, we had put in a request for investigative reports that are done by the military in these non-hostile deaths, which have some interviews and description of what happened to the soldier. And we had received a number of those reports after pursuing FOI requests for some months. So in some cases, in fact, we had more information than the family when we called. We would be either looking at an investigative report that they hadn't seen, or in some cases we also had called, you know, buddies and friends who knew them, knew the soldier while he was serving in Iraq, and had, you know, interviewed them or talked to them on background. So we yeah, I mean, odd situation when reporters from Connecticut are calling out to Oklahoma or Arkansas to a family and actually have a little more information on the circumstances of the soldier's death. The sort of thing that stays with Matt and I about this series is the amazing cooperation we got from families who had lost soldiers to suicide in Iraq. I mean, these are families who buried their, in most cases, sons as war heroes in these small towns, had no obligation to disclose that, in fact, there were mental health problems there. Had no obligation to talk about suicide, which is still very much taboo and a source of stigma. And especially in this military community, I mean, these are by and large the families that helped us with the series, looking at mental health, and helped us write these stories. We're very much pro-military, you know, second, third generation soldiers serving, very much pro-war. I mean, a handful are anti-war, but this was, you know, this was very much a pro-military community speaking out and saying, my kid died, and the military shouldn't have allowed this to happen.
Are any of the families who had loved ones who committed suicide considering any follow-up action challenging how the military handled their son or daughter or spouse's psychiatric problems?
A number of them have talked about wanting some kind of accountability from the military. Not necessarily financial. Very few have ever talked about that. They want, you know, they want to know who allowed this to happen, who saw, the signs of suicide or distress and didn't act on it and left my son or daughter over there, because the military doesn't disclose any any actions taken against superiors for ignoring these things or anything. And there's no indication in any of the investigative reports we've looked at that there are any negative consequences for overlooking a soldier's mental health problems leading to suicide. And a number of the families have wanted to take legal action. The problem is something called the Ferris Doctrine, which actually is a doctrine that prevents or makes it very difficult to sue the U.S. military. But the short answer is yes, a number of families have looked into some kind of litigation, but it's very difficult to sue the military around issues of negligence.
Well, I want to congratulate you on the George Polk Award that you won for your series of articles, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Matthew Kaufman and Lisa Cheticle are reporters with the Hartford Courant. Their series, Mentally Unfit, Forced to Fight, won a George Polk Award, which will be presented at a ceremony in April. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jonathan Lethem's new novel is about musicians with day jobs and the fine line between inspiration and plagiarism. Coming up, we talk with Lethem about why he thinks some forms of plagiarism aren't so bad. And David Bianculli reviews The Riches, about a family of con artists, starring Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jonathan Lethem, won a National Book Critics Circle Award for his novel Motherless Brooklyn, which was a bestseller, as was his novel The Fortress of Brooklyn. A couple of years ago, he was named a MacArthur Fellow, the so-called Genius Award. Lethem's new comic novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, is about four young musicians in an alternative pop band in L.A. who each have day jobs and are also involved in the performance art world. Let's start with a reading.
In this scene, the bass player from the band is sitting with Jules Harvey, who's a party promoter, and Falmouth Strand, who's a conceptual artist. And the two of them are proposing a kind of opportunity for the band, which at this point hasn't had very many of those. "Jules is a promoter," said Falmouth. "We're collaborating on a happening." I have a rather large loft, said Jules Harvey, apologetically. It's going to be a dance party, said Falmouth. Only the rule is you can't bring anyone you know. And you have to wear headphones. You have to listen to whatever you prefer to dance to, your own mix. If people don't have their own headphones, we'll provide them at the door, like neckties and jackets at a club. What I want is a sea of dancing bodies, each to their own private music. I might call it Party of Strangers, or maybe a party, like a part. Why? I get it, said Lucinda. Falmouth held up a cautioning finger. There's more. Instead of beginning and ending gradually and spontaneously, like the usual party, I want the start to be perfectly regimented. Everyone has to arrive at exactly such and such a clock and begin dancing immediately. Latecomers will be turned away. And then at the end, same thing. I may buy a starter's pistol. Falmouth had been thinking the backdrop ought to be perfect silence, said Jules Harvey. But I suggested it might be even better to have a band playing, very quietly, with nobody paying any attention. I thought your little consortium might want the gig, said Falmouth.
That's Jonathan Lethem reading from his new novel, You Don't Love Me Yet. There's another kind of conceptual art piece in your book, and this is a complaint line. I want you to describe what it is.
Well, right, the complaint line, it's a storefront, in this case a gallery, that has been turned into a kind of office space where people sit in cubicles. In this case, all women, and one of them is the bass player in the band, and they answer telephones that have been advertised as a complaint line. And it's not a complaint about any given subject. It's a kind of open-ended, you know, whatever your complaint is, we'll take it here. And they've been instructed to be very patient and kind of inviting and just copy down whatever the complaints are and be as generally reassuring as they can be to the callers. But, of course, they have no ability to improve any of the things that are being complained about. And I think in a way this artwork, it's a kind of joke about the retail world. I worked as a bookseller for 10 years before I was a full-time writer. And, you know, one of the things about, meeting the public in a work environment is that they always do have complaints, whatever else you're doing. You might be helping them find a book or a present or doing some other service, but they'll always have something, some grievance, and you're in the position of a kind of collector of grievances. And I thought, well, what if I just distilled the absolute pure essence of a encounter, a retail encounter, and stripped it of every other quality?
Actually, a Nova piece that was kind of similar to it, but not exactly that. But
well,
go ahead.
Are you thinking of the apology line? Is what I'm always reminded of, and I think it was famous in New York about 10 or 15 years ago.
Well, there was one in Philly. I don't know if it's the same one, but it was a DJ on a Philadelphia station who had the apology line, and you'd call in and just like make apologies to whoever you had wronged.
Yeah, this is very much derived from my memory of the stickers that were all around Manhattan on payphones and you know in bars that said Mr. Apology, call Mr. Apology at this number. And I think that was certainly one of my sources for this.
Now, the bass player in the band works this complaint line, and she has a complainer who calls a lot and who speaks in a really interesting way, and she takes phrases that he says while he's on the phone with her and fashions them into song titles and lyrics, because the real songwriter for the band is blocked. And so, for instance, he uses the phrase, the complainer uses the phrase, astronaut food, and she turns that into a song. What does astronaut food mean in the context that he's using it?
Oh, boy, it's a funny term to try to really describe. Astronaut food, as he describes it, is a kind of not quite sexual relationship between two people, members of the opposite sex, or it could be members of the same sex, who kind of keep one another on the shelf as a possible, emergency backup date or boyfriend or girlfriend, someone who you don't quite, you're not honestly completely platonic about, but you don't quite have the motivation to really make them into a front runner for your affections. So they're sort of just there in case of emergency. They're like a little packet of astronaut food.
So the tang of the love world.
Right, the tang of the love world. Yeah, or the peanut butter. You know, something you've got, you know it's in the house if you know, you'd never order out and get a jar of peanut butter delivered to your house. But if you're too lazy to even pick up the phone, you might reach for that jar.
Okay, so the lyricist, you know, the bass player writes a lyric called Astronaut Food. And she does this with a bunch of his unique phrases, with the complainer's unique phrases. So the novel raises the question, is that plagiarism? Is that like ethically wrong? And should the complainer be credited as one of the songwriters? What made you think about this issue?
Well, one of the things I love about pop music is the way it takes so many phrases, scraps of language that are just floating around. Vernacular language, even advertising jingles sometimes get turned into pop songs. You know, there were a lot of soul songs in the 60s, like I'd Rather Fight Than Switch, which was taken from a famous cigarette advertisement. Or, you know, Buddy Holly took the phrase That'll Be the Day from a John Wayne movie called The Searchers, where John Wayne says this phrase, oh, That'll Be the Day, over and over again. And it amused Buddy Holly, and so we turned it into a song. And the way this kind of language sort of belongs to everyone and no one seems very interesting to me. It's an example of art that doesn't have an absolutely clear source. It somehow rises up out of the collective consciousness to a degree, and then afterwards it can be a bit of a puzzle trying to figure out where its energy and power comes from.
My guest is Jonathan Lethem. His new novel is called You Don't Love Me Yet. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Lethem, author of the novels Motherless Brooklyn and The Fortress of Solitude. His new novel, You Don't Love Me Yet, is about four musicians in an alternative pop band who discover it's a fine line between inspiration and plagiarism. So, you know, you wrote a recent article in Harper's Magazine about plagiarism and appropriation, and you come down strong in favor of how artists should have the right to appropriate. Is there a line, though, for you between appropriation and plagiarism?
Well, you know, for the sake of that piece, and I still, you know, kind of like to think this way, I decided to just render plagiarism a value-neutral term. Instead of talking about plagiarism as if it was automatically a shameful, horrible thing to be accused of or to admit to, you know, maybe we could instead talk about good and bad plagiarism. I mean, everyone recognizes the reprehensible, you know, uninspired, covert borrowing as a, you know, kind of pathetic thing to do. When someone passes off someone else's work as their own, especially, of course, in an academic or journalistic context, or when someone leans so heavily on someone else's work as a source and never says that that's where the material comes from, anyone can agree that it's, you know, very bad, very shameful. But the fact that right next door to these, you know, easily condemnable practices are all sorts of other practices that are very typical of the arts is rarely, I think, completely understood or let alone accepted. Everyone learns, for instance, to create things by imitating other things. Languages are acquired imitatively, and so are creative languages. And art doesn't come from nowhere. It's cobbled together out of sources, out of influences, and well, you know, sometimes it's Buddy Holly taking That'll Be the Day out of John Wayne's mouth. You know, do we wish him not to have responded that way to that line of dialogue? I doubt it.
You know, in keeping with your thinking that appropriation is a good and necessary thing for artists to do, you've made several of your stories available for adaptation into the form of a play or screenplay. Tell us why you decided to do that.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that's important to say about that choice is that it's not that unusual. What's unusual is that I'm sort of announcing it. I'm bragging about it a lot. I'm making it very...
Well, you're saying you wouldn't charge for it, too.
Usually, overt. But right? You know what, Terry? The truth is there are a lot of artists who... A lot of writers, let's say, who at times will give away some of their writing in some sense. They'll either write something for a benefit anthology or contribute it to a magazine that doesn't have any funds, or if a absolutely impoverished but very sincere and talented filmmaker or playwright says, you know, I really want to make something out of your story. You've got a short story, and I really think it would make a tremendous one-act play, but I can't pay for it, will quietly instruct their agent to make a little deal for a dollar. This isn't something I invented. It's very normal. But what I'm doing is sort of saying, hey, look, we give things away sometimes. That's part of our work, and I'd like to actually, as it happens, I'd like to do more of it. I'd like to invite people to come and find some stuff for me to give away to them instead of waiting for it to come to me. And the reason this seems so important to me is that in this realm where people talk about intellectual property as though it is an absolute concept with very easily defined terms, and I want to suggest that actually there's an enormous gray area. There's a really big spectrum between charging for something and giving it away, and that artists are engaged in doing both a lot of the time, and that the impulse to make art necessarily combines these two urges to be rewarded, you know, to have someone, you know, give you something back, but also to set something free into the world, to add value.
So the stories that you basically put up for adoption or adaptation, did you get any takers?
Well, yeah, there's a handful of filmmakers who've jumped in, and a couple of people are trying to make plays out of them too. The part of the project that actually has had the most immediate action, and it's a lot of fun, is that I also put some song lyrics up. And because it's of course much easier for a musician or a band to go into a room with a four track and record a song and then send me an MP3, I've already gotten 15 or 20 really great, really funny songs back from these lyrics that I put up as what I called promiscuous materials.
Well, the songs and the stories that you've made available for people to, you know, appropriate is called the Promiscuous Materials Project. And I'd like it if you could play a couple of different melodies that were written for a lyric of yours that you put on that site. Could you do that?
Sure, yeah. A great example of the kind of, let a thousand flowers bloom results of this website is the way the songs can come out sounding so different, even though I've offered up the same lyrics. So here are two different musicians doing the same lyric. It's John Linnell, familiar to some people as one of the singers in They Might Be Giants, and a band from Massachusetts called Haunt, each doing a song called The Second Longest Night.
Emily at the Continental Divide saying, why don't you bring your friends inside? You tell her that you'd like to, of course, but your friends are down drinking at the White Horse. Paula says, that girl's got a crush on you. And you say, I know, but there's nothing I can do. The one that's on your mind is dancing with her friend, and she's telling the joke from Alphaville again. You can't get anywhere staring at the one you love. You can't get anywhere staring at the one you love. No, no, no. You can't get anywhere.
Emily at the Continental Divide saying, why don't you bring your friends inside? You tell her that you'd like to, of course, but your friends are down drinking at the white horse.
Okay, that was John Linnell, followed by a band called Haunt, doing their melodies to a lyric by my guest Jonathan Lethem, who's made several of his lyrics available for no fee to whoever wants to use them in a song. And it's part of what he calls his promiscuous materials project, things that he's written that he's just putting out there for anybody to use in any way. So you're pleased with the results you're getting?
Well, it's all a lot of fun. I mean, you know, I don't make any, it's probably important to say, I don't make any great claims for these as lyrics. I think, you know, for my taste, the best songs are written by, you know, singer-songwriters whose lyrics are inherent to their musical expression. And these are, you know, these are kind of a trifle for me. But what I like a lot is the kind of energy, the fizzy, improvisational, collaborative energy that comes from throwing stuff out there and having it thrown back at you. And it's enjoyable to me in principle as well as because these are funny songs.
Just one more thing. In naming your project the Promiscuous Materials Project, did you want to intentionally give the project a kind of sexual sound to it?
Yeah, you know, I it's kind of a joke about the idea of free culture equaling free love in some way. I didn't think that hard on it. It just seemed like a kind of grabby name. In this case, I'm probably guilty of being a bit of a, you know, opportunist, because the word promiscuous probably has a kind of motility on the internet that something else might not.
Oh, you mean if somebody Googles promiscuous, they'll find your project?
Who knows?
Is that what you mean? I'm not sure what motility means. That's why I asked.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, on your new novel, the cover of the novel is a large photograph of you a few years ago, some years ago, I think.
Many years ago.
Okay, sitting on what looks like maybe a college dorm bed with some kind of like wall hanging behind you and a guitar sitting next to you. And you look a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I was a bit uncomfortable. Well, you know, the book is so much about youthful postures, the kind of agonizing pretensions of young men and women in their 20s sort of trying to make themselves into some kind of grown-up artist. And there I was. I had this picture of myself that seemed to confess the same truth, and I thought it was a nice way to sort of say, I'm not making fun of anybody. Or if I am, I'm making fun of myself first for having that same kind of mixed-up, yearning pretentiousness that young artists do everywhere. You know, the irony of trying to become a writer or a painter or a musician is that you basically have to be a fake first. You have to pretend to be something before you can possibly persuade yourself or anyone else that you've got something really interesting to offer. And so that photograph captures me kind of playing at a self that is pretty much one I abandon. You know, I'm sitting beside an electric guitar, but it looks like I'm sort of afraid to touch it. And I thought that sort of described, you know, the degree to which it kind of answered a question that I knew I was going to be asked, because I'd written a book about a band. People were going to say, well, so were you ever in a band? And I think that's about as close as I ever got, is like I wanted to be seen proximate to an electric guitar. I wouldn't have dared to pick it up, but I wanted to be on the same, you know, on the same futon with one.
And when you were posing with this guitar, what did you think it was saying about who you were?
Well, you know, I mean, you can see I'm trying to, like, basically burn a hole in the camera with my gaze. I'm daring you to say that I am, you know, full of it. So obviously I thought I was about to become, you know, somehow miraculously a rock star. But I'm, you know, it's basically a pose that ought to have been reserved for my bathroom mirror.
I should point out you're wearing like white or beige pants here, which is not not your typical.
Must you?
Like rock and roll.
You already called my apartment a dorm room.
Well, we'll have to part on this note. Jonathan
thanks
Lethem,
for having me,
thanks
Terry.
So much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Lethem's new novel is called You Don't Love Me Yet. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new series, The Riches, starring Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver.
This is Fresh Air. Tonight on the FX Cable Network, Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver star in a new drama series called The Riches. They play Mr. and Mrs. Rich, a wealthy couple in a gated community. More accurately, they play a couple playing Mr. and Mrs. Rich. TV critic David Bianculli has a review and an explanation.
The Riches starts out one way, and you think you know where it's going. Wayne Malloy, played by Eddie Izzard, is a con man. Actually, he's a modern Louisiana gypsy, part of a nomadic clan known as Travelers. Like his fellow gypsies, Wayne and his three kids cruise the South in a giant, beat-up mobile home, picking out ripe targets for fast cons, pickpocketing scams, and other petty crimes of opportunity. His wife Dahlia, played by Minnie Driver, would be in on the cons too, but she's a con herself. She's just about to be released after 2 years in prison. The Riches starts off with dad and kids invading a high school reunion. The kids pick pockets and empty purses, while dad, pretending to be one of the graduates, takes over the festivities the way Vince Vaughn did in The Wedding Crashers. Then everyone reunites with mom, and that's what The Riches seems to be about. A family of con artists trying to be honest with one another while taking advantage of everyone around them. Except that in this new inventive series from playwright Dimitri Lipkin, a sudden tragedy alters everything. Two wealthy people, the Riches, die suddenly in a remote auto accident, and Wayne and Dahlia are there to hide their deaths and adopt their identities. Before you know it, Wayne and Dahlia claim to be Doug and Shireen and move into the couple's brand new home in a lavish gated neighborhood. You have to suspend a lot of disbelief to buy the premise. You have to accept, for example, that the Riches bought this mini mansion over the internet and that no one in the neighborhood has set eyes on them. And that Doug Rich and his wife moved to town not because of a new job, but just because of a pre-scheduled job interview with a major law firm. But it's easy to go with the flow, because Eddie Izzard, as Wayne pretending to be Doug, is such a confident confidence man that he seduces the viewer as quickly as he seduces his marks. The first day in his new home and his new identity, he accepts a neighborly invitation to join a golf foursome, where he meets up with a super wealthy, super aggressive loudmouth named Hugh Panetta, played by Greg Henry. Hugh, thinking Doug to be the new lawyer in town, takes his best shot. Then Wayne, as Doug, takes one of the drivers from Doug's golf bag and takes his own best shot, right off the first tee.
I don't know you, do I? Oh, I'm with, you mean old Sand Trap here?
Doug, meet Hugh Panetta, biggest ass east of the Mississippi.
You flatter me, Jim. How's that 30 handicap coming along? So what do you do when you're not pissing on my golf course, Doug?
I'm a lawyer, Hugh.
Liar, huh?
A lawyer.
Now, what I just said? Where'd you go to law school?
Georgetown, class of 88. Summa cum later, Hugh.
Why, it's a small world. Bill's a liar. Raymond's a liar. I hear liars pull it left. How do you pull it, Doug?
I'm not your average liar, Hugh.
Oh, here we go.
Eddie Izzard, a former stand-up comic, is all energy all the time here. He's like Robert Preston in The Music Man, and just as fast and loose with the truth. And Minnie Driver, as Dahlia, dives into her role completely. In tonight's pilot, she spends most of the hour looking about as bad as an actress can look. totally in keeping with her character's status as a recent ex-con with a drug problem. But by episode 3, in her attempt to pull off the biggest con of her life, Dahlia metamorphoses into an absolute beauty. That con, of course, is to hit the biggest score of all by going straight. The three kids enroll in school, Dad tries to find a job, and all of them try to hide from the new head of the Gypsy Clan, who's after them for a very good reason. I have no idea what led the folks at FX to consider casting two British actors as Louisiana gypsies, but Izzard and Driver succeed very nicely. Driver's accent, in particular, is just right. Whenever one of these two is on screen, The Riches is enjoyable. When both of them share the screen and take on one another in passion or anger, it's absolutely incendiary. Up to this point, the best FX drama series have been built around flawed characters in noble professions. A rogue cop in The Shield, opportunistic surgeons in Nip Tuck, a self-destructive firefighter in Rescue Me. With The Riches, the central characters are just as flawed, but they're no heroes. Yet they're so smooth and gutsy, you end up rooting for them anyway.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. If you want to catch up on Fresh Airs that you've missed, you can download podcasts on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts at pewtrusts.org, funding the international traveling exhibition Benjamin Franklin, In Search of a Better World, now in Denver. This is NPR, National Public Radio.